Blog Talk Radio.
2009 marks the 25th anniversary of the Sundance Film Festival, and tonight we speak to two incredible talents who have films in the competition lineup this year, actor Kevin Corrigan and director Dana Hines Perry. It is all coming up next on Movie Geeks United. Everybody, how's everybody out there doing? This is Movie Geeks United. My name is Jamie.
And my name is Jerry. Welcome to our show.
Yeah, it's another great show. Excited to do this post-holiday edition. Holiday, man?
It was all right. It was all right. Everything was going well until, like, this morning, and I hurt myself, you know, I hurt my knee. Not badly, but enough to put me out of commission for a little while. So,
but
you know.
But you just work out far too hard at the gym, man.
I do.
You got to do like me. Work out for 5 minutes, take a 20-minute break.
I think when I go back, Jamie, that's exactly what I'm doing. I'm also bringing like Doritos and stuff too to the treadmill.
Right, that's the excuse I use. I got a bum knee. You know, I can't.
But it is true. I overdid it.
Well, that happens to the best of us. We got a lot of great show tonight. Sundance centered for this first hour, but of course afterwards we'll be discussing a lot of the holiday releases that we've caught most of this season, including The Wrestler. You saw The Wrestler.
Yeah, The Wrestler.
Curious Case of Benjamin Button, Doubt.
I think those are like the three big ones that we'll definitely be talking about. And I guess Valkyrie, if we want to go there, and Gran Torino.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I do think our first guest is on the line, though. I have a 213 area code.
Awesome. So let's get right to it. My system is down again tonight, so... My good buddy Jerry is running the switchboard for us. We're an unbeatable team, so let's get started with the show tonight. Our first guest tonight is a tremendously talented actor whose film credits include Goodfellas, Billy Bathgate, True Romance, Bad Boys, Trees Lounge, Henry Fool, The Departed, Superbad, Definitely Maybe, which, Jerry, I got to tell you, this is a little advanced peek here. That movie will make my top 10 list this year, Definitely Maybe.
Okay, cool.
And the Pineapple Express, which I bet will make your top 10 list this year, too.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
His new film, Big Fan, was recently selected as a nominee in the dramatic competition at Sundance. It is a tremendous pleasure to welcome Kevin Corrigan to Movie Geeks United. Kevin, are you with us?
Let me pat
you. Can you hear me?
Yes,
I can.
Can
hear you great, man. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you guys?
I'm terrific. How was your holiday?
Well... It was a mixed bag. I did a one-man show that actually was more than one man. It was me and three, four friends of mine.
Uh-huh.
I did some short films and did some live acts. I did a Steve Buscemi tribute. I did an impression of Steve from the movie Life Lessons, and I think that went really well. And I also got some very sad news about a friend of mine who was a great actor, who your listeners might be familiar with, maybe, if they watched. And for anybody who watched The Sopranos, I didn't really. But my friend, my dear friend, John Costello, played Johnny Cakes. The gay
right.
volunteer fireman who
right,
and he passed away, that was kind of sad because John was always a huge inspiration on me and my work, and being around him was like being at the actor's studio. Every moment I ever spent with him was pure, you know, theater. And he was Brando. He was Bob Dylan. He was just one of the greats. And he didn't think he was great, which made him even greater.
Right, right.
Right.
I'm so sorry for your loss. But
that was so sad to hear about.
Tell me a little bit about him and how you hooked up with him and what he gave to you.
Well, I met John through a mutual friend who also an actor, a great actor who's a guy named Michael Cunningham, or Mick Cunningham. Mick Cunningham was in a movie, The Brave One,
as a
cop. And anyway, Mike and I made our film debut together in 1989 in a movie called Lost Angels. Mike went on to be in a movie called Die Hard 2, and that's where he met John Costello. And he said, "Kev, you got to meet this guy. He's great. He's just one of us. You know, you got to meet this guy." And I met John shortly thereafter in 1989. We were all represented by the Writers and Artists Agency, and you know, and that's how I met John. We were all like, you know, John was from Brooklyn, I'm from the Bronx, Mike was from, you know, Jersey City. We all were like Irish Catholic,
right?
You know, sort of guys who loved all the same movies, like, you know, Scorsese movies, and
right.
We were just like kind of Irish gangsters, you know,
right?
Actor gangsters, you know, like Mike was in State of Grace as a gangster, and I was in Goodfellas, and John was in the movie Last Exit to Brooklyn. He actually had a very substantial role in that as Ricky Lake's husband. And, John and I were actually in a film together. We didn't have scenes together, but we did spend time together down in Wilmington, North Carolina, shooting a movie called Billy Bathgate.
Yeah,
which was about Dutch Schultz, the old Jewish gangster from the Bronx, played by Dustin Hoffman in the movie.
Yeah,
John,
that was the Robert Benton movie, wasn't it?
Robert Benton, Kramer versus Kramer, right? Other films, and John and Steve Buscemi were Dustin Hoffman's henchmen, but I. You know, right away, you know, John was very passionate about, you know, and he had a very strong political point of view. He was one of those guys that was like, oh, don't get him started about politics or religion. Because he would just go on these Elia Kazan, like these actors, these Stanislavski and just intense monologues about he was a political activist, and he was all about human rights, and he brought all of that into his acting. To him, acting was like a political act. I just felt like a lightweight compared to him, but he left such an impression on you that because he was so open. And that's what you're supposed to be in acting, is open, like Marlon Brando, like James Dean, like De Niro and Pacino. These guys, they make such the effect that their performances have on you is so visceral. They you remember them forever because, you know, like John Cassavetes movies, they're so real, they're so uncomfortable. They really, truly get under your skin. They go right into your nervous system, and that's what it's all about.
Mm-hmm.
And every movie that I've ever been in, every performance I've ever given, I've wanted my DNA to come through the performance and sort of touch people in the audience to make them laugh, or at least to make them laugh. I don't know if I've ever made anybody cry, you know.
But the connection.
Kicked in the head, I thought.
Well, yeah, I
love that film. I love that film.
I'm glad. You know, that was about a guy who wanted to tell the truth. You know, he was searching for the truth. you know, we tried took a kind of a tongue-in-cheek approach to it. You know, I was sort of telling Matthew Harrison, the director of that movie, about my, you know, tales of woe.
Mm-hmm.
I was 24, 25 at the time. I had never had my heart broken. Well, I had. It was newly broken. And
mm-hmm.
I was telling Matthew all the stories about how it got broken. And he made me see the humor in it and said, we should make a movie about this. And that movie became Kicked in the Head.
Mm-hmm.
And then Scorsese recognized some kind of something in it, and he became the executive producer. So I thought, man, it's true. John was right. The more real you are, the more personally you take it. But not that John was the first person to ever bestow that wisdom on me. I mean, Robert De Niro said that in interviews, and he was like, Robert De Niro was like Elvis to me, you know.
Yeah. of course.
And he said, you know, I mean, I've never had a conversation with Robert De Niro, but his words, his supposed words, because Brando always said, you should never believe anything you read, you should never believe anything you hear. But I did read, you know, De Niro's biography, and he said that everything has to be personal, you know, like acting has to be personal, and I don't know. You can drive yourself nuts with all that stuff. Like Brando says in the On the Waterfront, you know, when Eva Marie Saint tells him, like, you know, you just have to listen to your conscience. He goes, would you cut it out with that word? It's all I've been hearing lately. It's driving me crazy. But you know, conscience, great acting is all about, you know, letting your conscience come to the surface, and there are ways to act and make a living acting where you don't do that, but I've never been interested in that.
No.
And when I was working on a sitcom, you know, I went into all 91 episodes of the show Grounded for Life as if it was a movie, every one of them, and my co-star in that movie, Donald Logue. Also, another just tremendously huge-hearted, beautiful human being, Irish guy, I'm kind of jumping the gun here, but
go on.
Yeah, I've met a lot of great people, great actors, you know, who have, you know, mentored me and who've been friends to me and who've helped me to articulate myself when I was kind of, you know, tongue-tied to express myself, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway,
that's fine.
Please go on.
We'll get into. I definitely want to talk to you about Scorsese and the new film, Big Fan. But let's follow this for just a little bit, because talking about John, you talked about his interest in politics and different issues. And I saw a recent interview with Peter O'Toole, and he said that actors are human beings just like everyone else, even more so.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking the great actors, they seem to be passionate about life. I mean, they have a very special passion about life that comes through in their work. Don't you find that so?
Oh yeah, and Peter O'Toole is another one of my all time favorites, and it's true. I mean, you know, like passion, and you know, O'Toole, and I mean, I remember, you know, like thinking, Peter O'Toole and drinking and acting, and, you know, someone, you know, gave a eulogy for John, who quoted the book On the Road, and said that John was like Neil Cassidy, who was the real-life sort of madman who inspired Jack Kerouac.
Right.
And Kerouac said that he only cared for people who were mad to live.
Right.
And we're mad to feel things and to experience things. And I guess, like, sometimes you can be so mad to live that you have to quell that passion with you know, drugs or alcohol. And,
right.
You know, drugs and alcohol play such a big part in the creative life, whether the, you know, you're talking about a writer or an actor or a musician,
right.
And all that. I mean, that's a very basic kind of, you know, now we all know, you know, some of the greatest creators were also some of the craziest people who took the most drugs or drank the most. Was it, you know, that stuff that made them crazy, or were they, did they take that stuff to calm themselves down?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it was a little bit of both, but
I think so too.
Yeah, you know, you know, when you're kind of having a good time, you want to drink to celebrate. When you're having a really lousy time, you want to drink to deal with the lousiness. So
mm-hmm.
It's an all-purpose thing that can sort of get, of course it can get out of hand, but you know, I think to you know, and Scorsese talks about movies and, you know, movies and acting. I mean, I was a big fan of movies before it ever occurred to me to be an actor.
Right.
But I think all those years in my, you know, infancy, when I was like 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, watching Planet of the Apes and The Wizard of Oz, and even The Deer Hunter I saw on television when I was 9.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And I loved it, but it never occurred to me that I wanted to be an actor. It was just movies. And what Scorsese says about movies is that they are life. I remember he's in some interview where he says, what the hell do I feel about movies? They're life. They are life.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you have to be scrupulously, you know, into what you're doing when you're making a movie, because otherwise, you know, what's it going to look like if you don't care
right.
about it? And
yeah. We're very passionate about movies like that here on this show. I mean,
we love those movies. We live for them.
There's a place for all kinds of movies, but if I'm looking for a movie and a performance and a work of art that connects, makes a connection, and I think that's what you're talking about. I mean, an actor feels a need to connect. So you would do a Grounded for Life and treat it like it was a movie. I mean, it was a serious endeavor because you're working towards connecting to that role so you can connect to other people that see you in it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I know how I felt watching. I mean, I used to be really kind of cynical about TV, and these days I just don't know why I felt that way. I think I was just being kind of cocky in a way,
mm-hmm.
and I was like, you know, I'm a real actor. I can't be doing, you know,
right.
TV. And yet, I watched so much TV growing up. You know, I was one of those kids who, you know, was like, you know, you're sitting too close to the TV, you're gonna ruin your eyes. And you,
right.
You know,
right.
You gotta get outside. You watch too much TV. You know, that stuff is junk. You know, the Brady Bunch and One Day at a Time and.
Right.
You know, but I watched it all in the Family, Sanford mm-hmm. and Son, Taxi, MASH, Barney Miller. The list
mm-hmm.
goes on and on and on. I just sat in front of that TV and took it all in like it was, I mean, I think up until the age of 6 or something, you know, and you supposedly don't really differentiate that much between, you don't know that you're alive, really. Like, you don't know you're in the world. It's
mm-hmm.
all kind of a dream.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. I know what you mean perfectly by that.
Yeah, I don't know, you know, like Freud called it or somebody like that called it the oceanic experience, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is how babies perceive reality, you know?
Right.
And you know, we're babies until, not everybody, some people are kind of, you know, some like 5-year-old hit in Baghdad as a man. You know what I mean?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the life that he's been handed. You know, here in America, we're eating Fruit Loops and watching sitcoms and playing video games, and not that people don't do that all over the world, but you know, in certain parts of the world, we don't have, those things are luxuries. You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean,
right.
they're luxuries
right.
here, but we take them for granted. But you know, I there was something about like certain. You know, I don't know if you guys might be too young to remember. I mean, I'm pretty much too young to remember, although I do remember a show from the mid-70s called Mary Hartman.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
of course.
I remember when her husband had the heart attack. That was a big deal. I remember that vividly because it scared the hell out of me. She was a nervous wreck, that actress. I'll never forget that because that was on, like,
yeah.
deep UHF. I know people probably in our chat room are like, what is UHF? But I will... I remember that show vividly. A couple of
times. Oh yeah, I'm friends with her now, Louise Lasser. I was actually in an acting class with her in 1991,
cool.
and then I was out of touch with her for over 10 years. I mean, it was only a year, 2 years ago that I called her up because I was looking to cast a part in this movie. Big fan.
Right.
She's going to Sundance now, and.
Mm-hmm.
She would have been in that movie, but she had an injury and she couldn't do anything. But we, you know, like I did say, I don't know if you remember me from your acting class, but we ended up like every time I get on the phone with Louise, I'm on the phone with her for at least an hour, because she like John Costello and like other people I know is just. Deeply passionate, and to a certain degree, you know, whatever you want to call it. It sounds pejorative and kind of not nice to say, neurotic. I don't exclude myself from that. I'm not as highly neurotic as we're all neurotic. You know, it's pretty commonplace.
I think
right.
everyone is, and especially in this day and age,
yeah.
I think that's a fair characterization of everyone.
Yeah, and I think that's where movies come in, and TV and pop culture generally is there to sort of solder the loose ends of our frayed nervous systems, you know? Movies, they complete us, and they are a kind of... I think movies are substitutes for dreams, you know? I mean, what the hell did we do before we had movies, you know, before film was invented? How did we, you know, I think it's vitally important to dream. I mean, I'm talking when you go to sleep and you have dreams. It's very important to do that. I feel a little sorry for people who say they don't dream. And I know a lot of people who, you know, don't have much to say on the subject because they don't have them, apparently. Like, what do you do? You go
yeah.
to sleep and you just don't, you wake up and you have no memory of anything? That's crazy, because I really start to feel quite fatigued when I don't have a really vivid dream at least
mm-hmm.
once a week. You know, I wake up, I can breathe again after. I'm like, oh, my God, I had a dream last night that just explained everything for me, you know?
Oh, that's wonderful how you can remember your dreams. I mean,
I'm impressed.
I'm fascinated by this, too, because it is said that everyone has dreams, but it triggers some kind of memory suppression in the brain where you can rarely remember your dreams. So that's impressive that you can actually remember your dreams. And I think you're
yeah.
absolutely right about the connection to cinema.
Cinema, it's just, it's like dreams. You know, you watch movies now, and it's like, oh, my God, it's just like a dream.
Mm-hmm.
But...
Mm.
Dreams
Tell me about
just, dreams are just like movies, you know. So I think it's not just a nice thing that came along, and it's wonderful that we have it now. I think it was inevitable that movies, that cinema would become, that it would,
yeah.
that someone would invent it, you know.
Right.
Speaking of dreams and movies, working with a dream director like Scorsese,
mm-hmm.
I mean. He is the
in a movie called Dreams.
That's right.
Akira Kurosawa. Yeah, played Van Gogh. It's a beautiful film. Tell me about what sets him apart. You've worked with so many directors, but he has a particular passion. And how does that translate into how he directs you?
You know, I've worked with him twice. He never really, you know, they say this about Woody Allen, too, that he doesn't really say anything to you. I haven't worked with Woody Allen, but people say, you know, what was it like working with him? Like, it was great. He didn't even say anything to me. He just let us do what we wanted.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, how does that make him a great director, then, if he doesn't direct anybody? And maybe there's something to think about there. You know, maybe great directors just leave the actors alone, you know.
They let you find it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They provide an atmosphere. I'll tell you one thing about being on the set of a Scorsese movie is that you show up and the environment is there. All you need to worry about is being in character, because everything else is set up for you. It is like flying first class.
Mm.
Compared to any other movie set you could be on. To be on a set of Warner Marty's film is like being in like first class on a jet. Like, man,
yeah.
this is everything it's cracked up to be. This is like, you know, there's no last minute tweaking, like, oh, you know, like the shot has been figured out, the scene has been lit to perfection.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
By Michael Bauhaus or whoever he's working with, and it's just like you are like on, it's like being in a real baseball stadium on a real baseball diamond.
Mm.
You know, it's like kind of, I mean I've never been on like in Yankee Stadium out on the field, but it's like when you walk in and you see the grass is like so green,
right.
The dirt looks like, it just looks like, oh my God, you know, like you really have, I mean, in order to run that 90 feet, you know, the regulation kind of,
right.
It's the real thing. You have to show up with the real ability to run those bases and
right.
to hit that ball coming at you 100 miles an hour. It's like that on Scorsese sets, and it's like, I remember on the set of The Departed, the first thing I said to Ray Winstone, I turned to him and I said, I couldn't feel less worthy of being here.
Yeah.
And he said, I feel that way too, mate, you know. And like and he's Ray Winstone, you know what
right.
I mean?
Right.
It would seem like a really special energy, because everyone there is probably thinking, I'm doing a Scorsese movie.
Yeah.
Just believe.
Yeah, it's like you kind of, I mean, everybody feels that way with the possible exception of, you know, whoever might be there who was also around when they made
right.
Mean Streets or something,
right.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
It's like, you know, they're kind of like, you know, it doesn't really faze them as much. But, you know, to everybody else, it's like, you have to sort of work backwards. You have to do you kind of have to work on reducing that sense of awe. And,
yeah.
And the way that I do that, I'm very lucky that the first time I worked with him, I was 20 years old, and I was still kind of, you know, I was young enough that and fortunate enough to have been working in films at that age. It didn't take me until the age of 30 to get a job in movies. I was very lucky, you know. Goodfellas was only my second film.
Mm.
And I was still in that oceanic experience. I was
right.
still kind of dreaming about being in movies. I didn't go through any period of disillusionment. Like, movies aren't the, I guess movies aren't that important. I guess it's never going to happen. I never had like a, you know, the dream never died. The dream was
right.
still, well, you know, it was still alive by the time I got hired by Marty. I really kind of, it was unfair because I mean, I did have that sort of disillusionment later on. Mm. But by the time I was working on Goodfellas, I was like, oh my God, it just seems like a week, like a couple of years ago, I was sitting and, you know, just bored to death in a high school classroom, dreaming of being in, like, Mean Streets 2. You know, I'm like, I just don't know how, but I just know that they're going to make a sequel to Mean Streets, and I'm going to be in it. I don't know how that's going to happen. I'm going to conjure it up out of my own fantasy. I'm going to will it into existence. It's going to be real. And, I mean, I did the practical things that, you know, it was like, look, if you really want to do that, there are some practical steps you must take, you know. Uh-huh. Pick up the phone book, you know, look for acting schools. And I did that. You know, I sat there with my mother and I went through the yellow pages looking for, you know, acting schools to go to. That all led, you know, all the roads lead to Rome or whatever. I was still young enough and sort of like enough of a kid to go up to Marty while he's trying to set up a shot, you know. And saying, hey, Marty, and just to call him Marty, you know, I don't think I even called him Mr. Scorsese. I was like, hey, Marty, can I, and he's like, wait, what is it? What are you, this kid's always coming up asking me questions. What do you want? And I was like, oh, no, I'm sorry. He goes, I'm only kidding. What do you want? I just was wondering, you know, like there was that Spanish music in Main Street right after Johnny Boy throws the dynamite off the roof, and then Charlie and Johnny are running to the, you know, they end up in the cemetery in the next scene, but there's this, like, Spanish music that's playing, like, he goes, yeah, that was Ritmo Sabroso by Ray Barreto. I used another one of his songs in my first film, Who's That Knocking at My Door, called El Watusi. And I was like, oh, I never saw Who's That Knocking at My Door. He goes, oh, yeah, Harvey Keitel's in that, too. But, I thought maybe somebody wrote that for the movie. He goes, no, that's from all my personal collection of 45s, you know. I'll make a copy of that for you. And I was like, oh, great. And that was back before we were burning CDs. We didn't have CDs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 2 weeks after I wrapped on Goodfellas, I got a package in the mail, and it was a cassette tape with Ritmo Sabroso and El Watusi on it, complete with, like, crackles and scratches that you could hear. He actually put the vinyl down and transferred it to a cassette tape and had his assistant send it to me. And it was just one of the greatest little sort of mementos I ever got. And I, unfortunately, I lost it.
Oh,
but,
no.
But
you lost the gift for Marty.
It was awful. It was drinking.
There it is. The drinking.
I know what you mean. It happens to me too. Don't worry about it. But I mean, Marty, though. I mean,
yeah. Let me ask you about this because I've always been curious about this, and then we'll get into Big Fan. I promise. Scorsese is known. I mean, obviously he's an international director, but for a certain New York sensibility. Perhaps unfairly, because he's made all different kinds of movies. And you're originally from the Bronx, and you've spoken very affectionately of your collaborators that come from that area, too. Is there a special style of performance or a sensibility that comes from growing up in the New York area that comes with acting for you?
I appreciate that question. And I mean, I, for one, think there is, but there's also, you know, That specialness comes from anywhere. You know, like, I'm sure Gerard Depardieu is, like, a great actor in mm-hmm. part because of his upbringing and wherever he's from in France. I don't really know exactly where he's from, but wherever you're from, you're going to bring something of your roots with you into your work. I mean, if I was an acting teacher, I could not emphasize that enough. But there's also a you know, a school of thought that you should erase those roots or something. I don't know. Maybe that's not I don't know. I'm a huge, huge Beatles fan. And John Lennon, you know, used to say that we were the Beatles were the first entertainers to come out of England who didn't hide their working class roots, even though they weren't really as working class as he sort of suggested they were, and he was the least working class of all the Beatles. But you know, the same. The point was that, you know, they didn't hide their Liverpudlian accents, and they were like, you know, as he said, a Liverpudlian accent was akin to a Brooklyn accent.
Right.
And, you know, I take that to mean just Bronx accent, too. And I went into acting thinking, you know, I'm not losing that, you know. I used to get it a lot, you know, from people saying you should take some voice classes or speech classes. And part of me believed it a little bit. But I got over that. I was like, no, that's where my truth is, you know. I'm not going to,
sure.
You know, so, and I think that's why I ended up working with Scorsese, because he could see just from my first audition for him that, you know, this kid is like...
the real deal.
If not the real deal, he's doing the stuff, you know, he's doing
right.
But it was real, and I mean all of my performances are based on people that I know. It's a little bit of me, you know, it's half me and half whoever it is I'm channeling from my old neighborhood, my relatives. I told like a cousin of mine, who's like, I guess he's about 13 years old now, and he's grown up seeing me on TV and stuff, and we see each other at family functions, like, you know, how like Thanksgiving or Christmas
right.
and stuff, And I said to him, I forget what exactly he asked me, but the answer I gave him was like, you know, the most exciting, entertaining people you're ever going to meet are the people in your own family,
mm-hmm.
your uncles, your cousins, your brother and sister. I don't think this kid has a brother or a sister, but your cousins, your aunts and uncles, your parents, you know.
Right.
No one. I mean, and I said I've worked with like famous. I've worked with movie stars. I've met like, you know, all kinds of people in you know, show business and certainly a lot of interesting people. But nobody who kind of got under my skin and sort of taught me what it, you know, about the human experience as
mm-hmm.
much as my own family. And to
mm-hmm.
this day, I believe that. And you know, my. My family is very important to me, and my old friends too, because
of course,
that's where the accent comes from, and that's where the spirit comes from, and that spirit, once you put it in a creative, once you put it in a painting or you put it in a movie, it becomes universal, and
yeah.
someone halfway around the world, you know, who's never been to the Bronx, gets it, you know, because it's human, but it's just one. It's just one avenue towards that truth, you know. It's just you guys have your own, you know, roots wherever you're from. That makes
right.
everything you do, and everything that you, you know, it makes it special, you know.
Mm-hmm. And how does that apply to Sal, who's the character you play in Big Fan? What did you use to kind of build that character?
I kind of used my, for one thing, my brother and my father are rabid New York Giants fans,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not really I'm not much of a sports fan at all, but I grew up with these guys screaming at the top of their lungs over Giants games, you know. You know, the tremendous like emotional highs and lows, the joys and the triumphs the dramas have been played out in my house, and I'd like, God damn, I gotta wear earplugs, you know, to be around these guys when they're watching this Giant game. What's so important about it, you know? I would see them in their element, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I may not understand the game, but I know these guys.
Yeah.
I know the people that I live with, and they're not screaming for nothing. I could understand where they were coming through, where they were coming from on a very basic emotional level. So when I love the script of Big Fan because it's like the King of Comedy and Taxi Driver. It's about being obsessed with media personalities.
Right.
You know, people you don't know them. You don't know them.
That's
and
right.
You feel like you know them, and you believe you know them just because of what you absorb through the media, and you act on those beliefs, and that can be very
dangerous.
Dangerous, you know.
Because that's
an illusion.
That's selling them illusion.
Yeah, I mean, I acted on those beliefs, and I ended up in movies with people that I only knew through movies.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are some exceptions, you know. But this movie's not about that.
Right.
It's a story gone wrong. And the final piece of my identification with Big Fan is that I am a big fan of Patton Oswalt.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we all are.
Yeah. When I first got the script, I wanted to play the lead part, and when I found out it was already cast, I kind of said I wasn't interested, and. Then they said, they came back and said, it made sense to them that I wanted the lead part. And they said, does it make any difference to you that Patton Oswalt is playing that part? And I was like, Patton Oswalt? All right, I'll play his friend. That's great. That kind of eclipsed my interest in the movie as a movie or as a story. Suddenly, I just saw the opportunity to hang out with Patton Oswalt.
Mm.
I was like, "When am I ever going to get another chance to be in such close quarters with a comic genius?"
Just to fill people in, Patton plays an obsessive football fan. Is it of the Giants and a particular player in particular? That person that he idolizes ends up beating him up in a fight, and he has to kind of overcome that. Is that essentially what the plot of the film is?
Yeah, he's a guy who doesn't have much of a life. He's, you know, in his mid to late 30s, and he still lives at home with his mother. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I want you to know. And there's a story about that. I digress a little bit, but it just came to my mind. Someone told me a story that was told to them by Al Pacino.
Oh my God! You did it! You did it, Kevin! You just did it!
I idolize Al Pacino.
Yeah, you just did it. You just made sure you're going to come back on the show a lot.
Yeah, I mean, Al Pacino has readings of Shakespeare plays and just plays. He's that guy, so I wasn't there when this happened, but they were having a reading up in his apartment in New York, I guess, and there was an actor in the reading who was, like, I don't know, in his 50s. I can't remember the actor. He was also kind of a well-known character actor himself.
Mm-hmm.
Who still lived with his mother, and then someone, when the guy was no longer in the room, someone else started a thing like, you know, that guy, he's like 55 and he still lives at home with his mother, and so I was like, really, is that true? Wow, what's up with that? And all this kind of thing, and it was sort of a gossipy kind of vibe that followed, and Al Pacino said What's wrong with that? You know, the guy lives at home with his mother. Mother loves him.
Right.
He loves his mother. He can go home every night knowing that he's going home to somebody that loves him.
Yeah.
What's wrong with
right.
that? And everybody was just like, that was the end of the conversation.
Yeah.
Apparently,
that's a great story. That's a wonderful
story. You know
what
I mean? So anyway, like I don't say, you know, that the plot of Big Fan is, man, it's just about a guy who lives at home with his mother and he's a big loser.
No. I understand it. That's great.
Yeah. I
don't mean to interrupt, but we have two callers on the line.
Oh,
do you want to?
Okay.
One of them's been on for a while.
Okay, well, let's take a call.
Let's take a call. There's a question, hopefully. I'm going to patch them through.
Okay.
773, you're on the air.
You know what? I'm just trying to listen in because I can't hear you unless I call your phone number.
Okay, all right. Okay.
So
thank you.
I don't have a question. Sorry.
Okay.
Thank you.
We appreciate you hanging on. We appreciate that.
I love the conversation. Thanks.
Thank you. That always goes well when we accept calls.
Okay, we have one more that just popped up. Do you want to try that one? Or?
Yeah, let's see if we have a question here.
We'll see if it's like Russian roulette. Okay. 516, you're on the air.
How you doing? This is Jesse from Long Island.
Hey, Jesse.
Hey, Jesse.
First of all, great conversation because I'm an aspiring actor myself. So, I mean, you give hope and stuff, you know?
Oh, good.
I got a question. How was it working with Patton Oswalt and Michael Rapaport? Was it, like, mind-blowing, or...?
I've worked with Michael many, many times. I did not have scenes with him in Big Fan, but...
Oh, okay.
We have been in about 7 films together.
Oh, wow.
I think maybe a good 4 of those films, we had a lot of scenes together, and... He's like a force of nature, Michael Rapaport.
He is.
And he has some great sort of influences from his life,
mm-hmm.
but also the actors that he admires, you know, like John Turturro and De Niro. He is a great channeler of those people, their influences, and when you're acting with him, it's kind of like being in the room with those guys, or at least it's like you when you're in the room with Michael Rapaport, you're in the room with a very volatile energy, if I didn't know him personally, if we weren't friends, I might be afraid of him, you know. But I kind of felt like he was a tiger that kind of knew my smell and loved me and didn't want to eat me. You know what I mean?
That's good.
He was on the show a couple of weeks ago, and he is incredible. We love.
Oh, you had him on this show?
Yeah.
Oh wow. Yeah, he's and working with Patton was Patton is a big reader. He reads like the amount of information that he absorbs on a daily basis, whether it's books or he always had an iPod and he would be watching like a whole season of The Wire.
Mm.
You know, when
on the iPod. Wow.
Yeah, it's like I don't know how many gigs the thing had, but there was a lot of stuff in there, and whenever he had a spare moment, he'd be watching the stuff, and he was always really apologetic, you know, he's like, I don't mean to be antisocial, I just, you know, like, no, you know.
I've seen you in a lot of things, and you're a great actor yourself, and
Thank you.
Remember you for is Grounded for Life, actually.
Uh-huh.
What happened? Did they just feel like it should come to an end, or did you guys still have a few seasons and it was cut short? Because I still watch the reruns, and I thought it could have went for a few more seasons, right? Or did the writers decide to end it?
Yeah, I think it was a combination of the network just losing their enthusiasm for the show.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, once the network or once the company that is providing a whole structure and financing, you know, once the higher ups start to, you know, sigh with, you know, like, I guess, you know, once they start to sort of lose their crush on you,
right?
Then the writing staff starts to lose heart, and then it just kind of trickles down, you know. It's like you can feel it, you know. It was like, you know, in little ways, it would just, you know, you can tell when people just aren't trying anymore,
right?
And then you start to think, like, look, someone knows something that it hasn't been made public yet, but someone has decided that this is not going to be on the next schedule, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We're getting the axe. We can just feel it, you know? And I don't know why that was. I think, you know, they look at numbers, you know? And our numbers, well, you know, the Grounded for Life numbers just weren't, you know, we weren't performing the way other, we didn't turn into that 70s show, you know. We had a strong fan base, but it just wasn't as wildly, you know, we weren't as huge as other TV shows, and we had to be in order to keep going. And
right, I think you guys had more a cult following in a way, right?
I guess so, yeah. Yeah.
And,
although, you know, I mean, I, you know, I will walk down the street and, you know, there'll be some Con Edison guys digging up a hole, you know, on the corner of Chambers and West Broadway.
Right.
And some guy in a hard hat will be like, hey, you know, Uncle Eddie. And it's like, oh, man, that's like the biggest compliment, you know?
Oh, wow.
You know,
Long Island, what's your name? What's your name?
I'm Jesse. I'm a custodian at a post office, so if I seen you at a post office, I would have probably said the same thing.
Well, you know, I appreciate that a lot. It means something to me when I connect with, you know.
Are you going for now? Would the highlight? I mean, you reached highlights in your career that other actors. I mean, to have a career like yours, and is pride in itself. You know, you've done so much with your career that any aspiring actor can look at you and hope to have half of your career. Do you think? I mean, are you happy with what you've done, or are you looking to get an Oscar, or, you know, now it's just going more and more? You're setting higher standards for yourself, is my question.
Well, I've set the bar for myself, and everything that I've achieved, you know, and for the past, I don't know, 10 years has kind of been according to that bar. I haven't set it any higher because I've been making a living. It's been consistent, you know.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I think to aim any higher, you know, I'll come up with a reason. I will set the bar a little higher. I mean, I used to think about, like, you know, winning an Academy Award and stuff like that, but I think you don't really get there by wanting it just for the sake of, you know, you don't aspire for like a little statue, you know.
Right.
Anybody can, you can get that if you want. You can go and have that. It's a body of work. It's telling stories. I mean I didn't know this stuff when I was starting out, and even like late into my 20s, into my adulthood, I really didn't know. It takes a long time to make all the sort of connections. I'm not talking in terms of career connections. I mean the connections between abstract ideas and ideals and things like you have to know that the most important thing is telling.
Jesse,
estoy usando.
Jesse, hablando.
Sí.
Jesse, thank you,
thank you so much for calling, Jesse.
Thank you, Jesse. Bye bye now. All right, Kevin, thanks so much for spending so much time with us.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, guys. I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to ramble on like that. And
we've loved it.
Thanks so much. Have a great new year. Keep watching movies. Keep doing what you love. And I don't know.
Come back anytime you want,
anytime
Kevin.
Anytime you want, sir. Anytime.
We're big fans of you, and we're looking forward to big fan, too.
If we can get you and Mike Rapaport on the same show, that would be great.
we'll see about that.
Right, thank
man.
You, Kevin.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye. That is Kevin Kurgan. The movie is called Big Fan. It premieres at Sundance. Sundance, of course, runs January 15th through the 25th. Jerry, is that your phone?
I don't think it's my phone. It might be yours, but
okay. It's written and directed by Robert Siegel, who's on top right now because he also wrote The Wrestler.
That's right.
So, Jerry, since I'm unable to get on my computer, what does the time clock say? Does it say that we have
33 minutes?
Okay, great. We have this is our second interview here with another Sundance talent.
Okay.
And, whenever you play this, Jerry, if you could mute both mine and your line, so we can get rid of the clicking.
Okay, I will go ahead and do that. Let me just stop.
So this is Dana Hines Perry. She has a movie in the documentary competition at the Sundance Film Festival called Boy Interrupted, and it's a very moving, harrowing story. And she'll tell you about it, so I won't introduce it anymore, but this is a great conversation.
Okay, this is a Boy Interrupted file?
Boy INT, it says.
Yeah, okay, cool. Here we go.
I started out with my husband, Hart Perry. We started a company called, oddly enough, Perry Films in 1989, and he had been in the business for a while, and we sort of ended up gravitating first towards concert and music videos and then more towards music documentaries. So we had a long run of at least 10 years of where that was our main business.
Oh, wow.
And that was, of course, in the days when the music business was the music business and not what it is now. So there was money to promote artists. We would put artists on PBS, for example, sometimes with the co-productions with the record companies and so forth.
Oh, wow. Yeah, it's changed drastically now.
Yes, it did. And also music publishing stuff. I mean, it's all a different world now.
Yeah. So what was your goal to be a documentary filmmaker? And this was just kind of the music world was where you found yourself? Or?
Well, I mean, I knew I wanted to be in film. I actually have a degree in dance, of all things. Mm. But that early on didn't work out too well for me. So I started working in a film archive, and I became an archivist. So from there, I had a lot of knowledge of stock footage and so forth, and actually that's how I met my husband, working on a film of his, doing clip research. And I've always loved music. I have no musical talent myself, but I really appreciate others' talent, and I just thought it was a dream come true to be hanging out with bands and musicians I admired. Like one of the first projects I ever did, Hart and I went over to England and lived at Peter Gabriel's studio to finish a project for him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and
wow.
That was just a spectacular experience, and that was back in 89, so almost
goodness.
20 years now.
Yeah, what project was that?
That was called POV. It was a home video of Peter's. It was a big concert that Martin Scorsese had produced, and then somehow got over to us to finish up and fill out the storytelling, so we used the concert as a basis, and then actually, it was called POV, now I remember, because we went through all of Peter's home movies. So it was supposedly from his point of view.
Oh, wow.
And, so we had access to all his home movies, and we sort of built little narratives around the songs out of that.
Oh, that sounds
and then,
like
of course, you know, one thing leads to the other, and, you know, you start working with other musicians. And,
sure.
And, you know, and that was the area when VHS home videos were a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
you know, back in the late 80s, early 90s. So that was a good business for a while. But it eventually sort of dried up.
Tell me about your documentary, Boy Interrupted. Obviously, this is a very personal project for you. At what time did you think, I need to craft this into documentary and share it with the world?
Well, that's two parts of it. One is crafting the documentary, the other is sharing it with the world. So I've kind of, up until recently, had those two things separated because I never really thought that much about sharing it with the world. For me, it was something that I wanted to do for myself. And I don't know if your listeners are set up with what the movie is about, but Boy Interrupted is a film about my son, Evan. He was bipolar. He eventually committed suicide when he was 15. And, you know, it was his whole life almost was a quest to try to help him and find out what was wrong with him. There was no such thing as bipolar kids 10 years ago, or it's just starting. And we were faced with this challenge of trying to get help for this kid, and with, you know, very few answers and many, many questions. You know, it's a very long story, which is in the film, but the short part, you know, the short version is that at a certain point he was doing very well after several hospitalizations, and we agreed with his doctor to lower his medication. He ended up killing himself a few weeks later or a couple of months later. So in answer to your question as to when did I decide to make this film, I honestly, as I remember back to, you know, the days after his death, and just, I don't remember much, to tell you the truth. It was all a big blur, family and a lot of tears and all kinds of stuff. But I think at one point I just said, I have to make a film. I have to say something about this. This is just, it's too painful. It's too awful. No parent should ever have to experience this. I can't even believe it's true. I can't believe that it happened to me. And I almost need to prove to myself that it happened to me to show that it's really true, because it is so shocking. And so somewhere along, he died on a Sunday, and we buried him the following Saturday. Somewhere along that line in those days, I asked two family friends to film the funeral. And I guess what I was saying at that time is what I just said. I need to film this. I don't really know what it is or why, but we need to record this. And as it turned out, the funeral was this, like, incredibly supernatural day with storms like you've never seen. And, I mean, it was just an unbelievably emotional and dramatic day in every way. The lights went out, and we all felt Evan's presence, and it was really supernatural. So once that footage was captured, I was sort of like, oh, okay, we are making a film. And then, you know, I proceeded to interview everybody that I could, including his friends, doctors, teachers, and family. So after about 6 months of that, still not really knowing what I was doing, I connected with HBO, and they took an interest in the film and helped finance the completion of it. And so they sort of helped me focus on what the story was and so forth. And it was at that point that I really sort of started making the film in earnest. But it's, again, still not ever thinking about showing it to an audience. I mean, that was the farthest thing from my mind. So it really wasn't until, you know, we finished the film in August and we had some screenings, and I thought, oh, God, well, I've gotten through it. Now it's just going to be on TV and, you know, we'll all move on and nobody will really notice it. And then it turns out we got into Sundance, and it's a very different proposition than I had expected.
Yeah.
So that idea, you know, it's the idea of, say, you know, dealing with this very private, very personal experience, I'm now going to be presenting to an audience of strangers, which is definitely not ever what I thought about it to begin with.
Now will this be the first time that you've shown it to a mass audience or larger
of strangers?
Yeah.
Basically, new to 99% of the small audiences we screened for up till now, which is the worst, I think, really, because a lot of those people were close to Evan and his friends, especially. I had interviewed them when they were 15 or 16, and that was really a pretty big deal for teenage boys to talk about how they loved their friend and losing their friend. And I was particularly nervous about how they would respond, but they were all there and super supportive and came over to my house after. And, you know, we've all stayed in touch over the years, these young men who, you know, now in college. But I was much more nervous about that audience than any number of strangers at Sundance. Sure. Although we'll see. I mean, I'll get there and see. But for now, I can sort of say that was much more anxiety-producing for me.
Yeah. Tell me what the experience of actually making the film did for you, because when I read information about the film, they always point out that it almost acts as a form of therapy.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, it certainly was a form of therapy for me, in the sense of, like, look, we filmed our kids. They're, you know, both of us documentary filmmakers are some of the most documented kids who ever lived. So we had, you know, miles and miles of home movies. Obviously, in this context, I'm looking at them through a very different lens. But the experience was, as you would expect, extraordinarily painful and overwhelming emotionally. There were, you know, oceans of tears in the editing room, and the editor I worked with, Jeff Bartz, brilliant, brilliant editor, who has a really big heart. And, you know, we got to be friends during this process, and he got to know my family, and I was able to share the ideas and movie with him, and somehow, and together in that process, we were able to get through it. But I needed that person who was not part of the story to bounce off of to help me, you know, hold on to the storytelling, because obviously I'm in the story. So how do you gain perspective? I really needed that other set of eyes who could help me see what this stuff meant beyond me just mourning for my son. So the process was, you know, as I said, it was incredibly, brutally painful. But I have to say that I looked forward to going to the editing room every day, because every day that I went in there was time spent looking at this in its face. And somehow that gives you the ability to have power over it, or let's say the idea of taking experience and putting it in a frame that helps to have, to create a whole story, somehow takes the import away from its maker, in the sense, so you can stand back and look at it and say, yes, there it is. Mm-hmm. It happened, and it happened to me, but I put it in a frame for you so that we can all see an overview of the story, rather than have to live through the emotional hell that basically that I lived through. So it was extraordinarily therapeutic for me, and I know that Jeff Gilmore wrote that description in the catalog, and I thought he really nailed it. That it's, you know, that it's therapeutic for the audience as well. I hadn't really thought that, but I think that's probably true, because you're sort of going on my journey as I try to explain it, and just in the telling of the story is therapeutic. Well, you know, every time you can articulate something as horrible as suicide, I think it helps the person to just talk about it, because nobody wants to talk about suicide. I mean, that's a real taboo, and that's another reason they did this film, is it happens, and it's real. And why are we afraid of, you know, are we afraid that it reflects poorly on me? Do I think that I'm look like a bad parent because my son killed himself? I mean, that may be true on some superficial level, but I know it not to be true.
Right.
So I'm saying, talk about it.
Do you think that faced with the prospect of this film getting out there, as it definitely will, what benefit do you think it will give to the audiences? What do you hope comes out of it?
Well, I don't know what benefit it gives. I hope there is one. I mean, I can say that by just showing the audience what it looks like, because you don't often see this. You don't often get intimate with a family's experience of suicide. And I'm saying, look at us. You can come and see, and I'll open the door for you. I hope it helps parents who are dealing with this and their children and are dealing with the mysteries of it, of mental illness. It's like an invisible disease, because they often look normal and seem perfectly fine. I mean, and that's really hard to deal with, because there's nothing visible. I hope that it would, if anybody was sick themselves and thinking of suicide, I mean, I may overstate my influence, but again, you know, those people get this feeling like, it's only me, it's just me, I can do what I want. And the answer is incorrect, because somebody loves you, and if you do this, you will slay them too.
Yeah.
And you need, you know, you must remember that. And if I'm, you know, if my tear-streaked face can help you remember that, then good also. Beyond that, I don't know. I mean, I just hope that we can feel open to discussion and say, well, she did it, and she, you know, put her whole emotional life on the in public. I'm not saying everyone should, but I'm just saying maybe it will help someone else to sort of open up and say, look, I want to talk about this, or I want to share what happened to me. And
sure.
And in fact, you become, if you are a survivor of suicide by its nature, you're a confessor. People come to you or have come to me many, many times and said, you know, can I talk to you? Something's happened in my family, or I'm afraid that something will, or it happened a long time ago, I never talked about it. And they tell me, and everybody, you know, people tell me their stories. And I think that's good, because there is, should be a forum and a safe place for people to talk about whether it's, you know, whatever mental illness or stigma, the type of experience.
There is what is the extent of the stigma about mental illness now? I know that there's so much is still unknown. What kind of misconceptions are out there that you've found about mental illness?
Well, I think we're just really scared of it, and it is really scary because we don't understand it. It's not like a science that you can measure and count. As I said, my son looked perfectly normal, if not better, you know, and just like gifted in every way, and looks, intelligence, all of it. He was the whole package, and you wouldn't have known. Let's go back to Virginia Tech. Remember, the shooter of Virginia Tech had been in the mental health system, and there became a whole discussion of whether, you know, how much screening we should do for people. And I have a very mixed mind of that, because on the one hand, they might have been able to prevent Virginia Tech from happening had they screened that guy. On the other hand, if he's screened as dangerously, you know, potentially dangerous, then you're discriminating against an enormous swath of our population. So, you know, I understand why that you'd want to screen and what that's about and keeping, let's say, the campus safe. On the other hand, it would have made it very difficult for my son to become educated had it been out there. So, you know, I don't really have an answer there. I will say that my husband and I say this a lot, that because this, you know, psychiatry and the study of mental illness, treatment of mental illness is so much more art than science, that someday we'll look back on this period as the age of, like, leeches and bloodletting.
Mm-hmm.
There really is no science to it. You ask any psychiatrist
right.
how they treat, you know, they'll say, well, I'll throw a set of drugs at somebody and see what sticks. And that doesn't sound real scientific to me.
Yeah.
But that's the state of it right now, and I'm not dissing psychiatry at all. We got, you know, enormous amount of help from many people in the medical profession, but there's a long way to go.
Yeah, we just don't know yet.
We just don't know yet. I mean, one thing I'm glad to see is that on the tail of that bailout bill, I mean, forgive me if I'm wrong, I could be wrong here, but I think that Representative Kennedy's mental health parity bill passed along with the bailout package, and that is a nationwide requirement for insurers to treat mental illnesses with the same sort of inpatient days, et cetera, as other kinds of illnesses.
Oh,
to bring it into
excellent.
Parity with, like, cancer and blah, blah, blah. Because you hear story after story, mine included, where we're kicked out of the hospital again because insurance doesn't want to pay for it.
No.
I mean, don't get me started on that. That's a whole other... Well, Michael Moore, you know, he talks about
Sicko
that.
With Sicko, yeah. You know, I can... reading the description when the nominations were announced, when the festival was announced last month, and reading the films that were involved, I was immediately stricken by your film, and I am of the thought that films can change the world or change perception, and automatically I was taken by your film, and I think it's a beautiful thing that you've put this together. Is this kind of a it has to be kind of bittersweet.
Oh, very, very,
yeah.
Very bittersweet. Very, I can't tell you. I mean, of course, it's every filmmaker's dream to go to the Sundance Film Festival. You know, the fact
right.
that I'm going on a film about my dead son is very bittersweet, of course. And, you know, it's really funny because bipolar people are often bigger than life, right? I mean, that's the polarities. And my son was often bigger than life, very vibrant, active, creative young man, and he wanted to be a filmmaker, and he started making his own films, and you see some of that in the movie, so it's particularly bittersweet because he had ambitions in that regard to, you know, go into family business. Of course, he wasn't going to make boring documentaries. Okay, he made that very clear. But, you know, it's particularly bittersweet and ironic that, you know, here's a venue where that celebrates the director, and that's what he wanted to be. And you know, because of his action, I'm there, and he's not there. And that's, you know, something that I have to carry with me. But, you know, I will do so also in the service of showing what I can show to an audience in hopes of preventing anybody from having to go through this.
Does this feel like now that you've finished this film, does it feel like the beginning of another journey? Do you think that this kind of, I don't know if it's started any kind of feeling of activism within you that you'll carry throughout your life?
Well, I'll always carry activism for the prevention of suicide for my life because of this experience, and also for the treatment of mental disorders, especially in kids. I mean, this is my cause if I have one. I don't think I'm going to be picketing anybody anytime soon, but anywhere I can go to talk about it to anybody who will listen and will have me, I'll be there.
Yeah.
And I'm willing to talk about whoever wants to talk to me about it, I will talk to them. And, you know, I will always, you know, in regards to the film or not, you know, the film is like just a station on the journey of this experience to me. Mm-hmm. It will never say who Evan really was and what it was like to love him. But it is what it is, and it's part of the experience of loving him and losing him, but not the end. So it's an ongoing journey, and I will, you know, our whole family will carry his memory and his soul with us till the day we die.
Okay, Jamie.
Okay.
That was very, very depressing.
That was very emotional.
It was.
Yeah.
I mean, I was really, wow. I don't know. That's incredible that she was able to do it. I mean,
I think it's one of many kind of catharsis that she's
mm-hmm.
had
mm-hmm.
since this experience. And I think the opportunity to share it with others that will take something away from it will prove equally cathartic.
Right.
For her. And what else is film about? And it, just like Kevin said, film is life, you know, at its best.
Right. Exactly.
So I bless her, and I hope she connects with as many people as possible with this film, and Evan's legacy will be one of tremendous hope for the future.
I hope so.
The movie's called Boy Interrupted. You can read all about these two films that we've spotlighted tonight and all the other competition films by visiting the Sundance Film Festival website. Or if you're lucky enough to actually attend the festival.
Go to Sundance.
Yes, screw reading about it on the internet.
Yeah, just go there. Go to Park City.
I
want to
go.
That's right.
We have a couple minutes left. I don't want to get too detailed about these movies that we saw because I'm sure we'll reiterate a lot of it in our Best of 2008 list that comes up in January. Just kind of a thumbs up, thumbs down thing. Benjamin Button, you and I are both crazy about it, right?
I think, yeah. I mean, I really strongly actually recommend it because it's, in one sense, it's not what I expected, which is a good thing. But it's just like, it stays with you. It has a staying power that I haven't heard some critics talk about. A lot of critics just said it was sort of like, you know, very empty. Actually, some critics
mm-hmm.
that we've had on the show, to be precise, I'm not going to name anybody, but they have said it's like, you know, looking at two beautiful people and, you know, once you leave a theater, that's it. And I beg to differ. I say the combination of the film's imagery and of course, the soundtrack is just divine,
mm-hmm.
and the acting is superb, I think.
Yeah, I was telling you earlier today, I think it's an incredibly warm movie. Every criticism that I read of it was just wiped away. I was expecting one kind of experience prepared for by the critics, and I got a completely different experience.
That's right.
That movie will live. As I was watching it, I was thinking, this is a movie for the ages. I think it'll live.
I think so. I really do. I think you're absolutely right.
As the great fables do.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll talk more at length about that, because I'm sure that's going to be a film on at least one of our three top 10 lists of the year.
I think so. It's a good one. It's a real good one.
And I find myself, I've been thinking about it a lot. I saw it yesterday afternoon, and I haven't stopped thinking about it. Whereas a movie like Slumdog Millionaire, which is equally as exhilarating, I mean, Slumdog is a very triumphant movie, and I really did love it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really carry it very far with me when I left the theater.
Yes,
like I did Benjamin.
You're right. You're
yeah.
absolutely right. That's a very good way to put it. I agree with that. I can definitely live with that.
You saw The Wrestler.
I saw The Wrestler, and it's Mickey Rourke is as awesome as everyone has said. He is, and he's not only good. I think Marissa Tomei and I think Evan Rachel Wood are good, but I also think there's something has been overlooked on this film. Not to take anything away from Mickey Rourke, because he could not have done it. You know, the film would not work with anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you that right now. The film wouldn't work without him. But Darren Aronofsky, you know, a lot of people say, yeah, he's stripped down. There's not a lot of his visual, none of really his visual flair, but there are a lot of motifs that echo throughout his work, and you can say the thing about addiction is definitely prevalent here. There's just little things you'll see, images, like Marissa Tomei will definitely remind you in some scenes of Jennifer Connelly in Requiem for a Dream. So there are motifs here, and it is a very well-done film. It's not this thing that people are saying, oh, Rourke's here. No, it is actually a very solid film.
Yeah. Yeah, he's an incredible artist, and
yes,
he's versatile too.
He really
so
is.
I don't know why stripped down has to be a criticism. You know,
right?
When did that become against the law for
a
visionary filmmaker?
Did one with Jonathan Demme for Rachel Getting Married. So I mean,
yeah, which is another of those award movies I need to catch up with. But I saw Revolutionary Road. And I think it's Sam Mendes' best picture.
Okay. I don't have a hard time believing that.
Performances are amazing. I mean, it's another tale. You could reduce it to another tale of suburban discontent, like American Beauty.
Okay.
But
I read the book. I read the book, so it's a bleak. It's a bleak book. So, and I hear it's
yeah.
a very bleak film.
And there's only so much kind of internal, kind of elusive parts of a novel, especially of that nature, that you can translate into film. But in terms of what they came up with, it's an actor's wet dream. I mean, if you're a fan of performance, this is the movie for you. Not enough people are talking about DiCaprio, first of all. And Kate Winslet always is magnificent.
Yeah.
But DiCaprio, he's a great actor.
He is. I like him. Look, even in the stuff that I thought he was very good in Body of Lies. While I don't think it's a good film, he's very good. Blood
yeah.
Diamond, the same thing. I think his performance is extraordinary, but I think the film is beneath him in some way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But
yeah,
he's great. He is. He's very good.
Yeah, and Gran Torino, you and I both checked that out, and
yes.
we both really liked
I think
it.
That's worthwhile seeing, for sure.
I think that'll be a big audience favorite.
It is. I think it is definitely a crowd freezer. Definitely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is good coming from Eastwood. He's been making these very solemn, very solemn movies.
Yeah.
As of late, this one's got a lot of life and a lot of punch to it.
It does. There's a lot going on. Actually, there's a lot more going on, I think, than people give it credit for. There's a
yeah.
lot of very interesting stuff, and there's some great scenes. And I don't think we would buy any other actor like with the rest. I don't think we
no.
would not accept
no.
this role from anyone else. Except
the only other
him.
Person I was the only other person I was thinking of that could possibly get away with it would be Nicholson.
Yeah, I would say yeah, Nicholson. That's it. But otherwise,
yeah,
I can't think of anyone.
Yeah, but it's so tailor. It's like The Wrestler in a way.
Mm-hmm.
It's so tailor made for the baggage that man brings to
mm-hmm.
that part.
Yeah,
you know?
You're absolutely right. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
I couldn't get. I saw him the same day, and I couldn't get. You know, I saw Gran Torino first. And I couldn't get that out of anything. I was a little, like thinking that while watching the rest of them, like, wow, these are really two character-driven films.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So is the picture of award season kind of becoming clearer to you as you watch? I mean, you're more resolved than ever that Mickey Rourke should take it home, right?
I do think he should take it home. Now, you know, we had said a couple of weeks ago that it would be between Sean Penn and Mickey Rourke. I still think that, but I think...
Right.
I like Milk. I think Milk is a good film. The more I think about it, though, I mean, it does have its emotional pull and everything. I just think Rourke's performance is so,
mm-hmm.
it's just there.
It's hit the zeitgeist,
yes.
as they say. It's amazing how, it's like predicting who, I've said this before, predicting who will wind up in the Super Bowl or the start of a football season. 6 weeks ago, I thought, Milk's it.
Yeah.
After watching Milk, and I think you get the sense out there too, wherever that is, that Milk has kind of lost a little traction, certainly not for Sean Penn, but as a film.
Yeah, it has.
And I liked it fine, as you did. There was just some missing element that really didn't make me as passionate about that movie as
Look,
I wanted to be.
On the weekend before Thanksgiving, I thought that Milk and Australia were coming out. I figured, okay, one of these two is the Best Picture winner. Couldn't have been more wrong. Could not have been more wrong. Now, my thing is this, though. It's because of the SAG nominations, they're saying that The Dark Knight pretty much is not going to... I think Heath Ledger is definitely a given that he'll get supporting actor, but that it's not going to get the nominations everyone was talking about towards the end of the summer and the early fall. So my thing is this. Do you think that the clear front runner may be Benjamin Button?
I don't know. I mean, if I were to give out the award, I'd give it to Benjamin Button.
Okay.
But I think the field isn't, when you really look at it, really study the effect of these movies and how good they are and the caliber of quality, I don't think the field is too crowded to not include Dark Knight in the Best Picture.
Oh, I think
it
should be included.
It is one of the five Best Pictures of the year.
Yeah. Oh, I would definitely put it in. I would put that. And I guess, you know, if there wasn't an animation category, I would put WALL-E in there, but I think that's gonna just go into the anime, and it should. I mean, that's hands down. But I actually think that's a solid film on its outside of that. But I do think the momentum is still building around Slumdog, though, and I think that's going to...
The little film that could. Every year there's a little film that could.
And this could be the year that the little film actually does it.
Yeah.
But who knows?
It's a big mystery. That's why we love it.
Yeah.
We love award season.
That's right. We do.
This has been a great show.
It has been. The interview, both interviews were fantastic. It was great to talk with Kevin. We had him on practically an hour.
I know.
Great.
We didn't expect that. We expected half an hour, and it was just too good. I mean, he was too good.
He really brought it home with the late actor from The Sopranos. That was incredible. Yeah. I did not know that about him, so I thought that was great.
We have some great shows lined up for January. Of course, our best ofs, our Oscar roundtable. I also want to talk about Oscar snubs in the past. Maybe we'll go choose some years and talk about some things as a fun roundtable.
I think that would be a lot of fun.
Great interviews. We'll be speaking with talents like the cinematographer of Wendy and Lucy, and we're working on the cinematographer of The Wrestler as well. We're going to be talking to possibly Chaz Palminteri in the next week. We're going to bring you some great talents and some great topics. So we appreciate you guys joining us so much tonight. And, Jerry, let me just say, I hope you have a great new year.
Likewise.
Don't break the other knee.
I'm not going to break the other knee. I think I'm just going to... You know, I've been sitting up here. I have the ottoman, you know, my chair. Now I have the ottoman.
Right.
My leg is up. So, you know, I'm doing all this, like, with my hand reached over the keyboard, like a long, long distance.
Living large. Yeah.
Yeah, living large, yes.
Guys, Happy New Year to all
happy
of you.
Happy New Year to everyone.
Thanks for a great year, and we'll see you next Sunday. Another great show, whatever that might be.
Happy New Year, everyone.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.